You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We turn now to Monty Python and the Holy Grail for a bit of a silly beginning to a serious conversation about pain.
Now stand aside, worthy adversary.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that then?
I've had worse.
So the Black Knight can lose a limb without noticing the pain. It's just a flesh wound. For the rest of us, in real life, pain isn't quite so easy to ignore.
But do we all experience pain in the same way? And does pain mean the same thing to us now as it did maybe to our ancestors a century or two ago? Well, our next guest digs into those questions in a new book and makes the case that the concept of pain is a lot more complicated than we might think.
Joanna Burke is professor of history at Birkbeck College at the University of London, and her latest book is The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. Joanna, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm really thrilled to be able to talk to you.
So I would think, you know, pain is pain. It's a physical process, a sensation we all experience in roughly the same way. But you say, no, why not?
Well, this is what I had assumed as well. I mean, pain is something universal. It's physiological. And so when I started this project, I actually thought, like you do, that, you know, it's all the same. What is fascinating is if we look into the past, 18th century to the present, we see that the way people understood pain and also the way they experienced it actually changes dramatically over time, depending on what they think pain is and how they think they ought to be responding to it.
We'll get into that compare and contrast with the past in a bit, but one difficulty you point out that seems universal is the difficulty of putting pain into words, into communicating what it feels like to other people.
Look, Rob, you know, this is exactly why I started working on this book on pain. Basically, I don't actually tell the story in the book itself, but I was in hospital after a serious operation, and my morphine pump wasn't working. I was pushing it, and it just wasn't working. And I tried to distract myself. And so I started reading a book that someone had given me by Virginia Woolf called On Being Ill. She wrote it a long time ago, and it was fascinating, because in that book, she tells a story about how pain is incommunicable, it's outside of language, etc., etc. And my partner came to visit me, and I remember very excitingly telling him about this book, etc. And I noticed his face kind of changed a little bit. And I said, am I doing something wrong? And he said, Joanna, you have been talking for an entire hour about how pain is impossible to communicate and beyond language. An entire hour I was talking about it. And he said, you know, maybe it's not the fact that pain is beyond language and incapable of being communicated, but that people don't want to listen. And people, you know, don't want to hear this about other people's pain. And that got me really interested in pain, because basically, people in pain, obviously, they struggle to communicate it, but they do all the time, and they do so using very rich metaphorical languages, and I just find that really, really interesting.
Let's get into how that language has changed over time, and one thing that surprised me reading your book is, in some cases, pain is viewed as a positive experience, an opportunity either for religious reasons or reasons of personal growth. How has pain been perceived as a good thing?
Well, actually, in most of history, pain has been perceived as a good thing. I mean, clearly, in highly, you know, religious, highly devout societies and cultures and periods of time, you know, pain was something that was given by God. It was a gift by a loving God who was trying to teach us something, trying to teach us about how we ought to behave, what is wrong when we are sinning. We are inflicted by it, and it's inflicted by a loving God to teach us. Pain has also, in the past, widely been seen as something that creates a better person. It creates a person who is sympathetic, for example, to other people in pain. So pain is constructive. It creates communities. There's also, of course, the idea that, well, you suffer in this world, so you don't have to suffer in the next. So even after, in Britain and America, we have effective painkillers, basically middle of the 19th century, effective painkillers. So a lot of people refused to take them on the grounds that this would make them less better people. It wouldn't, you know, they would be lesser people, that somehow you had to learn from this pain. And even people who were not Christians you know, understood pain as something positive because, of course, of its evolutionary importance. So even if you don't believe in a God, you believe maybe in evolution, that, you know, pain is something that teaches you how you ought to react.
Right.
Now,
so
that all changes dramatically with painkillers.
There's this huge time lag between the potential to put somebody under for something like, you know, even an amputation, decades before people actually start using it reliably.
Exactly. So even when we have, you know, chloroform and ether, et cetera, people didn't use them or didn't want to use them. And I think we really have to note here that, of course, these kind of painkillers were given to certain people more than other people. So we have very, very good evidence, for example, that minority groups, African Americans, the poor, were much less likely to be given chloroform in operations than other members of society. So there is this kind of real imbalance, this kind of view that certain people actually don't really need painkillers.
Now, things have changed. I recently had some surgery myself, and the attitudes you just described were not my attitude. I did not welcome pain as a character-building experience. When did this change happen between thinking of pain as a positive to thinking of pain as something that can, and I guess more importantly, should be controlled when it's possible?
Well, it really happens around the 1870s. So, you know, mid-1840s, you get, you know, effective pain relief, but it takes a long time for it to really hit in. And really, it's the 1870s where combination of education, obviously acceptance of these new technologies for relieving pain, declining religious beliefs, you get the idea all of a sudden that pain is actually a bad thing. It's something that needs to be fought. So, you know, in previous centuries, the idea is that you submit to pain because it's meant to teach you something, or you submit to it, or you even embrace it as something positive. By the 1870s, that's definitely out of fashion, and you're supposed to sort of don your armor and fight it, you know, with all guns blazing. So you get the increase of military metaphors coming in to the way people talk about pain.
There's still a sense that there's a positive in enduring pain, stoically, not whining, not complaining, along with the talk of, hey, no, deal with pain. It's real and significant. How important is that conflict now in the present day?
I think we still have this stoical attitude. I mean, you know, when I mentioned earlier, I was in hospital in great pain and my morphine pump wasn't working. You know, I didn't want to disturb the nurse.
Don't want to be a bother.
I distracted myself, you know, so that's a kind of stoical thing, which still, of course, has high value. And, of course, high value also for certain people more than other people. So this idea of women in childbirth, for example, should actually, you know, bear their pain in a stoical manner is something that's still very, very strong in our society.
Well, we're starting to understand or try to understand what pain is more with the neural imaging and understanding of the way our nervous systems work. Do we know what pain is now?
We don't really know what pain is. I mean, you know, pain is pain is pain. What a person says is pain is painful. And I think this is an important thing that physicians and scientists also recognize, that, you know, what a person finds painful is very individual. It's affected by not only their physiology, but also by a huge range of environmental, social attitudes and contexts. I mean, for example, there was a really interesting study done during the Second World War by someone called Beecher, an American physician, who actually examined, him and his team, hundreds of men who had extremely severe injuries after combat in Italy. And what he discovered is that the majority of these patients, when asked, "Are you in pain?" said, "No, I'm not." When they were, and these are people who had lost their limbs, I mean, very, very serious injuries. And when they were asked, "Do you want pain relief?" In other words, reminding them that it was there if they wanted it. They said, "No, that's fine. I'm not in particular pain." But if someone mistakenly stood on their foot or gave them an injection in a clumsy way, they would say, "Ouch!" So, you know, and what he concluded, he came back to America and he did similar experiments with patients in emergency wards and hospitals, and all of them were in extreme pain. So the issue he came, the decision, conclusion he came to was that, of course, for the men on the beachhead waiting with severe wounds, you know, limblessness, etc., for them, everything in front of them was positive. They were going onto the ship, and they were going back, and they would be cured, they would be fixed. But of course, for the people in the emergency ward in America, of course, the accident was just the beginning of disaster. So they felt pain a lot more than, of course, the men on the beachhead. So in other words, emotions have a really major effect on whether we actually feel pain and the extent to which we feel it.
We're talking to Joanna Burke about her new book, The Story of Pain. She makes the case that pain isn't experienced the same way by all people, and that our understanding, our interpretation of pain has changed over time.
And you can join the conversation. Do you think that pain is a universal, the same for everyone? Do you see a generational difference in the way that we deal with pain? And when you're dealing with pain, do you try to shrug it off and keep it to yourself, or do you get help and maybe seek out a sympathetic ear? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Joanna Burke, author of The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers. She says pain isn't experienced in the same way by all people, and the meaning of pain has been changing over the past couple of centuries.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this in your own life? We experience pain differently. The way we talk about it maybe affects the way we feel it. And if you've ever had to use that 1 to 10 pain chart at the doctor's office or the hospital, are you stumped? Because you're like me, you don't know what 10 means exactly. No basis for comparison. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers right away, actually. We've got Eric on the line in Waukesha. Eric, hi.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. What do you got for us, Eric?
Let's see. At the young age of 19, I'm 35 right now, I was in a car accident. Someone pulled out in front of me, which left my neck fused in two places and a few positive hernia discs. I know a lot of people that sit around and they're in pain with their neck fusion, but when I start to become in pain, it actually makes me get up and move. Every time I start feeling that, I use it as a trigger. So therefore, after my surgery, I became a healthier person, because if I start getting a headache or that pain starts to kick in, I know I need to eat, I'm going to need to sleep, I need to exercise. So I've completely changed my health and my diet just around my pain. And, you know, in ways, I'm definitely a healthier person with it.
Interesting, Eric. Thanks a lot for sharing your story. So that's one approach, one response, Joanna. Pain as a trigger that we need to do something a little differently.
Yeah, and I think, Eric, you've got a really interesting point there. You know, pain is something obviously no one ever wants, but, you know, pain is something that we can use in positive ways. What I found in writing, researching and writing this history of pain, is that it was really fascinating to see how people like you, but people in the past, managed to use their pain in ways that actually forged better lives for themselves, but also for other people. And I think that's a lovely, lovely message for all of us.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Melody now in Ferryville. Hi, Melody.
Hi. I'd like to comment on the fact that I worked in a General Motors factory. I worked for 36 years. I started when I was 12. Subsequently, I've lost my back, and I've fused my wrist, and I've fused my back, and I still have problems with it. I did work 36 years, and I cried at my Social Security disability hearing because the last thing I wanted to do was leave work. I felt like nothing. I felt like I was a loser. I have to be on pain medication just to do my daily tasks. What's sad now is that it seems like there's such a stigma out there. If you're on pain medications, you're a drug addict. Having to go to Walmart, pick up your prescription, have to show your ID and sign something because the DEA is watching you closely. It is so embarrassing. I don't dare let my friends, family, or grandchildren know I'm on pain medication.
Melody, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm sorry for your story, and good luck to you. Joanna, though this is not an uncommon theme, we've got these pain medications. Some cases are encouraged to use them, but there's this love-hate relationship, too.
Yeah, this is something that really infuriates me. And the last chapter of the book deals exactly with what you're suffering. You know, the idea, it's vulgar, it's unimaginably awful. The idea that people in pain should not be get access to this medication that can help you, and not only medication, of course, techniques, technologies, etc., that can help you, is absolutely horrific. And the stigma associated with taking pain medication is there and really needs to be tackled. You know, the idea that someone in pain would become addicted to the medication is ridiculous. There is a huge amount of evidence, scientific evidence, that this does not happen. And indeed, there's a vast amount of scientific evidence that if people in pain actually are allowed to regulate their own pain through medication, they will actually take less. They end up taking fewer pain medication than if they are prescribed. You know, it's a really a terrible state of affairs that people are not given relief when they patently need it.
Well, and also Melody has something, real pain that came from probably repetitive work over the years, but it's not visible. It's not an accident with scars. It's not a war wound. Do she and maybe people who suffer from chronic pain syndromes have a stigma that and we don't take their pain seriously?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we always want to see proof of their pain. And this is something that it's a major problem in our society. And this is why I think we as a society need to actually have an argument, a debate about chronic pain. You know, something like 40% of Americans experience chronic pain conditions. This is it's a vast problem in all of our societies. And we need to have a conversation about that. And what I find, obscene, one of the many things I find obscene is, of course, that politicians who don't have these chronic pain conditions, you know, very easily sort of legislate against, you know, medication being given. But of course, as soon as they or their loved ones become a victim or, you know, suffer chronic pain, of course, they change their mind. And I just think that that is obscene.
Melody, again, good luck to you, and thanks for sharing your story. We've got John now on the line in Windsor. John, hi.
Yeah, about 6 years ago, I had knee replacement surgery. Both of my knees replaced. I was 50 years old. Now, I had my first knee surgery at 16, my second at 22, my third at 25. And at that time, the doc told me that you're going to eventually have a knee replacement surgery. So I refused, you know, I love riding bike. And at the time, I thought, you know, boy, if I have the knee replacement surgery, that's going to be the end of it. So I continued to do that for 30 years, and until one of my coworkers said, John, would you please go to the doctor and talk to him about your knees? And I'm like, why? And they said, because it's painful to watch you walk. Mm-hmm. And so I did. The doc told me I had to have knee replacement surgery. All of a sudden, you know what? I was in pain. So I think, you know, what you're talking about a little bit earlier where, you know, boy, you know, you see the pain that you're in, and you want to live life, and so you're not going to experience the pain because, you know, it's, you know, I think that that's a huge thing.
John, thanks a lot for the call. As we're starting to wrap up, Joanna, we have a lot of ways in our lives now that we have the possibility of relieving pain, whether it's a pain medication or a surgery that might fix our knees. How much has that changed our perception of what pain is?
Clearly, the fact that there are ways around pain now, there are many more options that we can take, makes pain less acceptable to us. But I think really the message that really has to come across is that the problem is not really with the pain patient. The problem is with those around the patient, the person suffering pain, who dismiss pain or who don't believe in it in the first place or who want to sort of shut it out of their lives. I think the problem is with witnesses to pain as opposed to people in pain themselves. We really have to take pain, people who say that they are suffering, we have to take them seriously. And I actually don't think we're doing that right now.
So a sympathetic ear can be a bit of pain treatment in itself.
Absolutely. You know, and the whole thing about placebo effect and everything, that we have really good scientific evidence that people who are in loving relationships or loving communities, who are believed, who can talk about what they're experiencing, what they're suffering, that they actually manage both to feel better about their pain, but also to turn around in some way that pain experience into something that can be used in a much more positive way, as our first caller was doing.
We'll leave it there. Joanna, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Really enjoyed talking to you.
That's Joanna Burke. Her new book is The Story of Pain, From Prayer to Painkillers.